This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sapora Berman knows big change. She could have been a middle-class success story at anything. Instead, she popped up on Canadian TV screens and then around the world as the passionate and photogenic spokeswoman for the anti-logging protests at Clackwood Sound, a gorgeous old-growth inlet on Canada's far west coast. There hasn't been any environmental protest quite like Clackwood before or since 1993. Canadians are generally a quiet, law-abiding lot. Yet over 850 people were arrested. They got their criminal records at this protest, perhaps more than at any other green protest anywhere in the world. Businessmen in suits bust up to get themselves a criminal record. Grandmothers and even children were dragged away to police vans and then to jail. 12,000 people joined the protest in the remote woods. The big band Midnight Oil came out for a free concert held in the infamous black hole of burned-out stumps. Clackwood Sound was designated a World Biosphere Reserve by the United Nations in the year 2000. Sapora Berman worked for some years for Greenpeace, helping to organize negotiations between the big logging companies and several environmental groups, including Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and Rainforest Action Network. Finally, years later, in another big step for environmental action, the largest companies joined the government and private foundations and the Aboriginal people in signing a protective agreement for the Great Bear Rainforest. Huge virgin rainforest valleys were saved for the future, while other logging had to meet sustainable standards that included wildlife protection. But then something happened. Zep, as she is known to her many friends, ran into a wall of fire. It was climate change. She'll tell us in her own words after a lively introduction by Maureen Jacques Lacroix of the Be the Change Earth Alliance.
Corporate CEOs in their big offices and convinces them that maybe they shouldn't put out those big catalogs, and they don't. And she's had a tremendous influence on the movement overall. She's going through an interesting transition herself right now because Forest Ethics was, she's a co-founder of, it's like having a child, having an organization like that. And now her child is growing up and she's letting it do its thing. She's only there 25% of the time. And she's starting a new organization called Power Up. And it's a citizen engagement program that is focusing on climate change. Because as she learned more and more about the urgency of what's happening with climate change, her perspective got broader and broader from the forest to the whole global situation. And she's a beautiful woman. She really integrates so much. When I was talking about all those dimensions, she holds all those dimensions in a beautiful way. She's been accused of howling at the moon as an eco-goddess, and she has been accused of being a rabid eco-activist, and she is innovating all the time how to approach getting people to wrap their heads around this new way of seeing things. So I'm honored and privileged to invite my dear friend, Sapora Berman, to speak with you all now.
Thank you, Maureen, and thanks to the Be the Change Earth Alliance for organizing this incredible event and for all the work that you're doing and for inviting me here today. So what I'm going to do is tell you some stories and a little bit about what I've been doing over the past year and how I let go of the work that I've been doing for the past 15 years and why. And what I'm doing now. And I hope that it can give us a bit of a level playing field for our conversations today around the urgency of the climate change issue and what we're facing, but hopefully also inspire you a little bit around the art of the possible and really taking this moment to be responsible not only for what we do, but for what we don't do, and to be responsible for recognizing that we really do have to be the change and we can't expect other people to do it. And I think actually that's what I was doing for several years. And, you know, you can't not hear about climate change, right? It's everywhere. It's front of Time magazine. It's in every newspaper. It's everywhere you go. And for a really long time, I'd been seeing those reports cross my desk as I was working on forest issues here in Canada and other places and thinking, wow, that's getting worse and worse. That is really bad, and I'm so glad someone else is working on it. And so for those of you who don't know me, I spent the last 15 years working on protecting forests and changing the trade of wood and paper products. And that journey has taken me from working with the Friends of Clackwood Sound and Western Canada Wilderness Committee on Vancouver Island and blockading logging roads. I was arrested in 1993 and charged with 900 criminal offenses. and then when that didn't work, when the blockades and the protests and the, you know, when the logging just continued, I worked with Greenpeace and then other groups and eventually founded Forest Ethics to go to who was buying the products and convince them that they had to use their influence to help affect forest protection and change in the way that paper is made in North America and what kind of wood is bought. So that journey took me to boycotts in the United States and Europe and eventually to other countries. And the end result of that work, to make a very long story short, for me, was that I found myself in a place about a year and a half ago where Forest Ethics had contributed to the protection of about 66 million acres of old-growth forests so far in Canada and the U.S. and Chile. And we had transformed the practices of some of the largest corporations in the world. I mean, when we started campaigning against Victoria's Secret, they were making a million catalogs a day. They were a million catalogs a day. They were primarily about 90% was coming from Canadian old-growth forests in the boreal. And they were using less than 2% recycled fiber. So, you know, and we campaigned against them. We launched a campaign, Victoria's Dirty Secret. You may have seen our posters or ads with a woman in lingerie holding a chainsaw saying, Victoria's got a dirty secret. That caught their attention. And the result of that was and 850 protests in front of Victoria's Secret stores in 18 months was that we ended up working with the senior management to green their practices. They became the first large catalog company in North America to have a dramatically changed procurement policy. And so here's the first story. There was a moment for me when I realized we had reached a new level of this work, when I asked Victoria's Secret as part of the agreement to work with us to change the way governments look at forest protection and forest practices. So they came with me to meet with a government here in Canada, and the government, the Ministry of Natural Resources guy was sitting there saying with the Premier's office, well, you know, blah, 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 caribou like clear cuts and we're doing fine, you know, that thing, and that they always say. And the guy from Victoria's Secret just leaned back and he said, I don't think you understand. I buy $100 million worth of paper every year. And I want to buy from Canada, but I can't unless you're providing recycled fiber and more Forest Stewardship Council fiber, unless you're protecting more forests and you're not logging an endangered species habitat. Like, I can't buy paper from you because it comes with protesters attached. So until she's happy, we're not happy. And it was this moment of, like, I realized, first of all, that I said nothing in the meeting. Didn't need to. And the guy from the Premier's office was just going, he couldn't speak. And it was this moment of realizing that we had we'd harnessed a whole new power through this collaboration and with industry. And it was very exciting. And so then getting back to where I am now, so that's all happening, and a report comes out saying recycled mills in North America are working at an all-time high, and it's because of the increased demand of Staples, Office Depot, and Victoria's Secret, which was Forest Ethics' first three campaigns. So we've started to change the way that paper's made in North America. It's huge. Then I was invited to speak at Bali, at the International Climate Negotiations, I'm clearly not using any of those notes, on the impact of logging on global warming. And Bali changed my life. You know, I knew a lot about climate change, I think we all do, and I had just started seeing the maps showing that the forests that I'd spent my whole life trying to protect were now under threat, probably more due to climate change than industrial logging, and I was trying to ignore that. I don't know how to deal with that. I work on logging, and then there I was in Bali, and I was sitting feet from the Secretary General of the United Nations, and he came out and he said, unless we reach a strong agreement here to reduce emissions, fossil fuel emissions, we are dooming humanity to oblivion. And you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, there's 30,000 people from over 100 countries. And I turned to the woman next to me. Did he just say dooming humanity to oblivion? Because I thought, and I just realized that, I mean, I've been called, you know, by Glenn Clark, premier of the province, an enemy of the state on national television, an eco-lunatic. Okay? You know, I've never said anything that crazy. And this was the Secretary General of the United Nations. And so then, you know, so then I thought, hold on. And, you know, I have to really listen. And I have to really let this sink in. So I went to every panel on the International Panel on Climate Change there in Bali that I could go to. And we all know, I think, in this room that global warming is happening, that it's human caused, that it's a direct result of carbon emissions that have been increased by 70% since 1970. You know, those are things that I think a lot of us know now, and we know that there's a scientific consensus. And what I didn't really realize is that we're experiencing the warmest planet that we have in 420,000 years, that the warmest 10 years on record are in the last 15, that the scientists are now saying a 2-degree warming is unavoidable. Unavoidable. So what does that actually mean to us in our everyday lives? Well, a 2-degree warming is unavoidable. Well, the difference between now and the last ice age was 2, 3, at most 4 degrees. So then I started going to the predictions of, okay, so if we just stabilize emissions at where they currently are, which we're not, what's going to happen? And I went to the Africa panel where they said that by 2020, that's not very long, you know, 11 years, Africa, many countries in Africa will produce 50% less food. That by 2020, there'll be 2 billion people in the world that don't have enough water. By 2050, there will be 150 million environmental refugees. To put that in perspective, we have 23 million environmental refugees on the planet today. And not environmental refugees, but just refugees totally. And people are dying every day. 150 million? And I started grappling with the fact that these issues aren't issues anymore for those of us who have a soft spot for big trees and bears. This is the moral challenge of our age.
This is Green 960 AM in San Francisco. You're tuned to the Radio EcoShock Show. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We're listening to longtime forest activist Sabora Berman explain why she became a climate change activist.
It's the challenge of our age. And how do we grapple with something that big? So imagine my horror when the next day the Canadian government arrived and spent the entire international negotiations playing way above its weight and stalling an international agreement. I mean, I've traveled a lot internationally, and you meet people, and they love Canadians. Oh, you're not American. Hi. You know, oh, ginger ale. You know, they love us. And there I was in Bali at the international negotiations, and you'd meet people, and they'd say, oh, you're Canadian. I'm sorry. And it was like, whoa, you know? And so I came home determined to figure out what is going on. Like, how is it that Canada has some of the weakest laws and policies in the world to address global warming? How is it that our emissions are rising faster than any other G8 country? And I found what I'm sure many of you know, and folks here from the Dogwood Alliance and other environmental organizations that are working on tar sands and oil, of course, know this very well, that Canada's home to the single largest fossil fuel development on Earth. And that while we are all driving to work and changing our light bulbs and changing our lifestyles, Canada's emissions are going up because of heavy industry. And in fact, 40% of our projected emissions in the next 10 years are projected to come from the tar sands. And it all of a sudden hit me that, yeah, we need to change our light bulbs, but we need to change our laws. And how do we create that conversation in Canada? So I spent a good 6 weeks on the floor of my living room playing Lego with my boys in my pajamas. And when they were asleep watching Battlestar Galactica and eating potato chips, that was my strategy for dealing with this new crisis, because I realized it made me question everything I do, my entire work in the world, and how we function and how we spend our time. And it was actually listening to Barbara Kingsolver on the radio one day that got me out of my funk. And she said, someone said, how do you remain hopeful? And she said, well, I'm a mom. Hope is the only moral choice. And it just hit me that, you know, I have to do everything I can. So I started researching and exploring the issue. I went and met with someone I knew in the Prime Minister's office, and I said, okay, help me understand this. I've seen the polls. Canadians care about global warming. We have some of the worst laws and policies in the world. I mean, China has stronger vehicle efficiency laws than Canada. The UK has committed to all carbon neutral homes. Right now, Obama is spending 6 times as much per capita as Harper is to create green jobs, to create renewable energy, to turn the US towards a low carbon economy. Why aren't we doing these things in Canada? I don't understand. And she said, these are difficult changes. And yes, Canadians care. They don't really understand it. They're not really organized. So we're doing enough. So then I went to a conference where the Prime Minister of Denmark was speaking, and oh my God, it was so inspiring. Denmark is doing incredible things, reducing their emissions, increasing quality of life, increasing community engagement. You know, people are involved in the transition. They're excited about the transition, and they have more jobs and a stronger economy today than when they started. And I said, how are you doing this, to him during one of the breaks? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, we just had an election where someone who was supportive of the carbon tax lost, and we don't see our government's not doing anything. And, you know, how did you have the social license to do what you did? And he said, civil society demanded it. I had no choice as prime minister. And so I decided that my work in the world was going to be to do this, to engage Canadians across the country from the right and the left around not only the urgency of this moment, but the promise that we have to understand the issue, to talk about the issue, to connect with each other, and collectively call for stronger laws to limit and reduce pollution right away. Because this is not rocket science, and I think the issues have really been obscured. I mean, I have 2 degrees, and I spent 6 months going, okay, I'm for 80% by 2050, but that's at 1990 baselines, and oh no, it's a carbon tax. No, it's a cap and trade. What are we for? What we need to do is limit pollution. We have to stop treating the atmosphere like an ashtray. We need hard caps on pollution across the board, and that includes the tar sands. And I think, in fact, that our government is going to be forced to do that as a result of what the Obama administration is doing. But we need to engage on that. We have to get off oil. We have to stop using fossil fuels. We have to increase conservation and efficiency as much as we can and support government leaders who are doing that. And we have to dramatically increase our sources of renewable power and move the economy to a low-carbon economy. So those are our kind of priorities. That's what we need to do. And how do we as individuals do that? We need to commit to talking about these issues, to, yes, changing our lifestyles, but it's not about buying the right product or not buying the right product. It's about engaging in civil society. It's about writing to your MLA or your MP. It's about joining any of the number of incredible organizations that are here today and who aren't here today but who work on these issues. The David Suzuki Foundation, the Pembina Institute, Sierra Club, or Power Up Canada. Any of these organizations who are trying to funnel and organize public concern into action on these issues. Because we have 3,000 days. And we cannot forget that. I met with the chief scientist of NASA, James Hansen, and he said, we have about 8 years before we reach a tipping point where there's literally so much carbon in the atmosphere that we could ban all the cars from the planet and global warming would continue to be out of control. It would continue to escalate and make an increasingly inhospitable planet. Violent storms have already increased by 50% just in the last 20 years. We have about 3,000 days to move to a low-carbon economy. And that means we have to be willing to change what we do in our daily lives and how we engage and teach our children. We have this strange society where we have an overdeveloped consumption muscle and an underdeveloped civic engagement muscle. We've forgotten how to volunteer. We spend our time at the malls. This is the time when we need to engage and when we need to volunteer, when we need to take risks, and we need to understand that there is no silver bullet. There's no one answer. This is messy, and change this fast is going to be messy, and we're not always going to agree. Those of you, many of you probably have seen the press around the BC election, the press around run-of-river issues, private versus public power. These are important debates to have, and we need to have them with heart. We need to engage in them. We don't have to agree all the time, but we need to respect each other and the fact that we're working from a place of purpose and intention and try and find the solutions together. Because anyone who tells you they know what the answer is in the climate era is not being truthful. We don't have all the answers, but we need to try and shift this beast in the right direction. And I'll leave you with one story. My grandmother, who was in her 90s, died this summer, and I got to spend 2 incredible weeks at her side. And I was having a crisis of faith, creating a new organization after having one that already had 34 staff in 3 countries, and it just felt like maybe I'm insane, and Power Up Canada was struggling to figure out what it was going to do, and the issue just seemed so incredibly big. And she said to me, "You know, when your mother was growing up, we didn't have a phone in the house. No one did. No one took airplanes, by the way. Like, that just didn't exist in anyone's lifestyle. The way that we communicate with each other, the way that we travel, the way that we fuel our homes, everything was different. We didn't have computers. We didn't have cell phones, let alone that Raspberry you're always carrying. She said, my BlackBerry. She said, "I have watched the world entirely change in my lifetime. And we are at a moment, you have the opportunity to contribute to the next change, because there's no question that we are living a tipping point. The world can entirely change in our lifetimes. We actually have most of the technology and science that we need today to change the world, to live in a low-carbon society." She didn't say that. I inserted that. That was my part. But what she said is, the world has entirely changed. And I'm sitting here telling you about what the world was like when your mother was a child. Tell me, what will you tell your children? And I said, "Grandma, I'm going to tell my boys about a crazy time when we logged the last of the old-growth forest to make catalogs, when we fueled our cars with gas. Because when I'm telling my grandchildren that, we won't be doing that anymore. Because we'll live in a different world." And I leave you with that image and invite you to share that image with me and to work every day in our lives and in our homes and in gatherings like this to continue that conversation and, in fact, to dedicate ourselves to that conversation. Because if we are the change and if we're committed to it, then we can make this change happen. Thank you.
That was famous forest activist Zipporah Berman, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock from Be the Change, May 23, 2009. That's it for this week, and thank you for tuning in on Green 960 AM, San Francisco, and green960.com.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.